Welcome to the October 10th, 2015 episode of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies with me, Lisa Schmeiser.
And me, Philip Michaels, who doesn't spoil the magic of when we record so that people think we're talking live to them. Podcasting is timeless. Podcasting is, hey, whenever. Podcasting shows up in your ear like an old friend saying, hello.
Well, I concur with you that there's the asynchronous nature of consuming media on the web.
Mm-hmm. Those are words that you said.
And that people do not necessarily consume in the same time frame. I feel like putting a date on this is pretty helpful because it lets people know when we saw movies, saw movie previews, and what we are talking about.
Okay.
All right.
It's a Captain Kirk star date kind of thing.
Well, why not?
Yeah.
I could make up my own star dates
yes.
from now on.
Okay,
do using it. Using a series of Fibonacci numbers.
Do it.
All right. 1, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21.
Captain's log. Mm-hmm. Today we saw The Martian.
Technically speaking, we saw The Martian on Wednesday night.
Again, I want to convey that we are timeless. We are floating in ether.
The point is that Phil and I actually managed to find a movie that we agreed on and watched while it was still in the theaters, which is very exciting for us.
Yeah.
So we did see The Martian.
Yep.
Phil, you had some thoughts about it.
I did. I found it to be a worthwhile entertainment. Not crazy in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought... Towards the end of the movie, there are points when I was thinking, okay, wrap it up.
You feel like doing the little circle.
Yeah, there was a guy off stage circling his finger around. Mm-hmm. I thought that the use of disco music was a bit overdone and sapped the tension out of the movie.
Yeah. That was your first criticism.
That was my major criticism of it because mm-hmm. I have not read the book.
Yeah. Disco does feature in the book.
I'm sure that it does. Mm-hmm. But... Even though I didn't really know the plot
yes.
and didn't know... I mean, one can assume, spoiler alert...
It's Matt Damon, he's coming home.
This is an Everest.
Yeah.
And Matt Damon ain't gonna die. But nevertheless, I felt the movie lacked tension, or at least it lacked tension for me.
I was talking about this movie with a friend of ours yesterday, Andy,
mm-hmm.
and what I really enjoyed about the movie... was how it quietly exalts brains over a deus ex machina, benevolent aliens coming down from the sky,
sure.
massive special effects, cartoons, anything like that. Instead, you just have people who calmly continue to work the problem. And because they are smart people who have confidence in their own smarts and who are nerdy and love being nerds, they are able to successfully work a problem in a way that, say, somebody stranded on a planet with a bunch of submachine guns or a chainsaw for an arm or something wouldn't be able to.
Sorry, Bruce Campbell.
No, I don't think he'd do well on Mars, though. Okay. I really don't. First of all, there's the lack of oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
But one of my favorite moments in the movie was when the crew of the Ares confronts a pretty thorny physics problem. They have 39 minutes to solve it. And the captain just says very calmly, okay, we're going to keep working the problem. And what that reminded me of was a passage in Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff that you mm-hmm. and I read. You know, you and I both read the book a couple years ago.
This is the book and not necessarily the movie, although I very much enjoyed the movie.
Mm-hmm. But this is the book about test pilots attempting to break the sound barrier, right?
And the early days of the space program.
And one of the things that Tom Wolfe notes in a passage is to be a test pilot or to be an astronaut, you have to have the kind of personality where if your plane is plummeting to the earth, it's on fire and parts are flying off, you're still very calmly working the problem, trying solutions and methodically problem solving. Like you just don't panic and you just don't think about failure. You keep going and you're like, every failure is okay. Now I have a piece of a bigger picture. What do I know? How can I use this? And I like that mindset was quietly typified. It was shown, not told, repeatedly again and again. Like, you never hear that Matt Damon's character, Mark Watney, is a brilliant botanist. Like, they really never beat you over the head with that. But the fact that...
they mention it.
He mentions it,
yeah.
But he's mostly being facetious.
I'm the best botanist on this planet.
Yeah, but in the book, you know, in the book, he's a smartass. That's basically... They mentioned in the book that one of the reasons that Watney was picked for the crew is he was the designated tension buster.
Ah.
That was his role in the crew's dynamic, was he was the one who could make sure that nobody got super serious about stuff and crawled up their own rear end with importance and self-seriousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he gets stranded on Mars, this is what actually makes him more temperamentally adept to the environment. than some of his other crew members. It's because although he's brilliant, he also doesn't take himself too seriously, and that's pretty helpful.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think I probably enjoyed the movie more than you did, mostly because I like this. I like the spirit of scientific can-doism.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great movie to add to a canon where technology is an answer, but it's not a perfect answer. You always have to refine and work the problem. I like that they showed the failures. What was interesting is we saw this movie right after I finished reading Neil Stephenson's Seven Eves. And that was another book where you have people who are doing impossible stuff in space. And once again, they're also shown to be working the problem, dealing with high margins of error, and continuing to work the problem. So mm-hmm. I liked that.
Yeah. No, I didn't not like the movie.
Yeah.
I was mindful of its flaws, but that's yeah. the kind of terrible person I am.
But, you know, people don't really tune in to hear us give considered opinions on movies we've seen.
No.
The whole point of this podcast is for us to ruin movies we haven't seen
yet. All of that was setting the table for the trailers.
We have three trailers we want to discuss today. The first is, of course, the Steve Jobs trailer.
Yeah, let's talk about that one first, that's much on the mind. Or, as my dad would say, the trailer for Steve Jobs.
The Passion of the Jobs.
Yes, because the movie of Steve Jobs is that God comes and gives...
Bill Gates market share.
Bill Gates, all these trials, boils, and he loses
and
everything.
And Windows 95.
Yes, and Windows 95. And
a brief tenure at Next.
And then Steve Jobs berates God in front of his colleagues, and God feels very bad about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Book of Jobs.
And then following that is the Book of Woz, which is, I just won't stop talking about Apple.
He was paid for his consultation on this movie.
Of course he was.
In case you were wondering why Woz is so enthusiastic about this movie, he was a paid consultant.
There was a piece I saw this week but did not read where Woz rates all the people who have played him in different movies.
Of course.
So.
I'm sure that Seth Rogen gets top billing.
Well, it's the most recent one.
Anyhow, haven't seen the movie.
I've seen the trailer.
I've seen the trailer. I'm interested in the movie. I say this as someone who had to see the Ashton Kutcher movie, which was simply Jobs, or as my dad would say, Jobs.
See, the thing is when Phil says he has to see it, he had to see it. He's not kidding. It was an actual work assignment.
It was a work assignment. I had to write the review.
It wasn't like, I'm so compelled to go see this because everything
yes.
else.
Yes.
No,
it was I saw it the first time at a critics screening.
Mm-hmm.
And... my reaction was, this movie is missing a reel, because who cares about this movie? Anyhow, so I went and saw a second screening just to make sure that they didn't change anything or before I wrote my rather not very good review of it.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I'm more interested in this one because I like the structure of it a bit better, where it's not a Wikipedia entry come to life, and then this happens, and then this happens.
Yeah.
It's built around three events.
I like Danny Boyle a lot as a director,
mm-hmm.
I should add.
Yeah, I can take him or leave him.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. I really enjoy him as a director. He feels kinetic to me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
Some of the things that he's done, which I greatly enjoy, actually, I like his early stuff a lot. I loved Shallow Grave.
Okay.
I really liked The Beach. I may be one of like five people who did, frankly. I love Sunshine. That's one of my favorite.
Yeah, I know you love that movie.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite dark thrillers, as it were. It's space travel as tense and claustrophobic and hopeless, and he does a great job with it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I think I'm leading out Trainspotting, which if you had to... pick a movie that typifies a very specific time and place. Like Trainspotting is basically your snapshot of 1995, 1996.
Yeah.
And there's always a certain kinetic energy, and he coaxes some very, very layered performances out of people. Like the best performances I've seen from the dude who played Bigby, Robert Carlyle.
Yeah.
Terrifying performance he coaxed out of him. There isn't a single bad performance in Sunshine.
What I have seen of Slumdog Millionaire, I did not enjoy at all.
Yeah.
But,
well, I really loved 28 Days Later, and which is, you know, the zombie movie that he did. And I greatly enjoyed that. And he does... because he's so kinetic, he manages to play with quiet and stillness in a way that's really ominous and disconcerting.
Mm-hmm.
So... Big fan of that as well. And I'm not somebody who likes the zombie genre normally, but, you know, there we go.
So we're recording this at some unknown time, when the Steve Jobs movie is in limited release.
Yeah.
A lot of my colleagues in the tech press have seen it. And what I'm fascinated by is their reaction to the movie seems to veer towards its accuracy.
And
I get that sense, but for a movie like this, with the way they're approaching it, where it is a very stylized type narrative, I feel that they're not really going for accuracy. I think that they're taking these events and using them to say something about the human condition, and not necessarily something about Steve Jobs as a man or a person.
It would be like transposing the people in the Kennedy administration to an actual retelling of Arthurian Camelot.
Right.
So these people are basically just meant to typify larger themes about humanity, success, things like that.
One of my favorite recent fiction books. See, I read two.
Really?
Yeah, occasionally. I sneak it in. Is Damned United, which is takes the real life story where Brian Clough was the manager
We saw that movie, didn't we?
Yes. But the book is much better than the movie. The movie's all right. Movie goes in a different direction than the book, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Brian Clough, he was a very well regarded manager, becomes the manager of Leeds United, lasts 44 days there before he's summarily fired.
Yeah.
And the book is about those 44 days, and it's told from inside basically his head.
The head of a man who's in severe distress.
Yes, in severe distress. Is it accurate? No, it is not accurate, according to people who were there. But it takes this real-life incident and finds greater truths about it. And it's weird to say that I don't think you should look at bio. The first question you should go into with biopics isn't, are they accurate?
Yeah.
I think you should go in and say, does this... Did I learn anything from this? Did this speak to any larger truth in the universe? As I was telling you this morning, it's not like the founding fathers who wrote the Declaration of Independence suddenly broke into song and dance around Philadelphia.
Well, you know, we really don't know that because...
No, it wasn't well chronicled, but it could have happened.
It could have happened. Yes. No, it didn't happen at all. For one thing, their music would have been terrible.
Wouldn't have been kicky Broadway tunes, I can tell you that.
No, that would have taken the country in a whole different direction.
Sure.
I think, to bring it back with biopics, I would like to see more biopics that are made that are about very narrow slices of somebody's life.
Yep, that's the way to do it.
I don't want to see the whole big picture where you're like, and that's why Rosebud is a sled, or what have you.
No, that's a different...
But the point is sometimes when you see biopics, they'll have some incident that happens in childhood that is supposed to explain them through their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that you have to have a thematic device that ties things together, blah, blah, blah. But I feel like... laying all this groundwork in Act 1 to explain how somebody is in Act 3, I feel like that's overly simplistic, and that ignores the reality of how, as you get older, the story you tell about your life, the stories that you use to make sense of your life and your events, those all shift and change. They'll have different starting and ending points. And so, you know, one of the reasons I like Moneyball so much is it's about a very specific season, one baseball season.
Right.
Boom. It begins, it ends.
Well, really, it's a movie about an idea.
Yeah. And it's an idea that plays out over a very sharply demarcated calendar year.
And that movie is not accurate in the least.
Yeah.
If you were to watch that movie, you would think, my goodness, the manager, Art Howe, is a sinister villain. And nothing could be further from the truth.
No, but like, okay.
Who are Hudson, Mulder, and Zito? Who are these guys? Yeah.
Yeah, here's an example. I would love to see, for example, the biopic where Diane Weiss had 1 year on Law & Order.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to use that as the framing device for a year in the life of Diane Weist. Just explain it that way.
Fascinating.
I don't see why not. She's magnificent. I love her.
Interesting idea for a movie. No, Hollywood.
I'm trying to explain the power of just 1 year. Or if you wanted to, instead of making a band biopic, like when Oliver Stone made The Doors, the big mistake he made was it was the entire origin story all the way to Jim Morrison's death. They could have just chosen to make it about 1 or 2 years. Like, if they ever get around to making a Guns N' Roses biopic, it should absolutely 100% be solely around the tour supporting appetite for destruction. Boom.
That's it.
Beginning and end.
You're wrong, because it should be about the making of Chinese democracy.
No, honey. I said a biopic and a limited slice. Not the Kwiatkowski trilogy done three times in a row.
It would be like the Krem Master cycle.
No.
I wanted to interject there and just say Oliver Stone is terrible at biopics.
Yeah.
Because the Nixon movie he made is not a good movie.
Yeah.
And how can you make a dull movie about Richard Nixon? The man is a walking opera.
You have to work hard at that, to be true. So this is my complaint about biopics, is I really don't like the broad canvas. I feel like you should focus on one of the many stories a person tells about their life.
What is your favorite biopic?
Good question.
I can give mine. Okay. I'll give you time to think, since I sprung that on you.
Yeah, you did.
I will give my favorite, and I will give my least favorite.
Okay.
My favorite biopic is Lawrence of Arabia, which is, it's really two movies in one. The first movie is this epic swords and sandals kind of war picture adventure, and the second part is the bill coming due for part one.
Yeah.
And again, it talks about a very specific period in T.E. Lawrence's life. It does not talk about him much before the war. It does not really, apart from a flashback at the beginning of the movie, doesn't really deal with the post-war life. It's I think, the best biopic ever done. The worst would be Lust for Life, which is the Kirk Douglas plays
Vincent Van Gogh, to be correct. I'm sorry.
Vincent Van Gogh.
That's how you say his name, yes.
Mm-hmm. And Anthony Quinn is...
That's the most virulently masculine set of characters.
Paul blanking on the name.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who went to Tahiti. And,
oh, Gagan.
Gagan, yeah. Mm-hmm. Paul Gagan.
Mm-hmm.
And it... There's a chunk of the movie where it's just them. Basically, it's The Odd Couple, where they're living together and squabbling.
Uh-huh.
It's not a good movie, and it's really bad on a TV, because it was directed by Vincent Minnelli, who really loved his widescreen. And the ending of the movie is just all these Vincent Van Gogh paintings in CinemaScope, and even on a 36-inch or 42-inch TV, you're this is kind of stupid. I know what the paintings look like.
Mm.
But to audiences in the 1950s, it must have been fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very much a, and then this happens, and then this happens, and he goes a little crazy here and cuts off his ear.
Uh-huh.
And then they squabble over who got the pasta tonight.
And that's your least favorite.
That's my least favorite. Lust for Life. Don't you dare see it.
Okay. So, I'm going to think of a better answer, after we record this podcast.
After we
untethered from time.
We'll just insert it. Well, you'll say, well, Phil, I thought that the best biopic was Walk the Line.
No.
That wasn't a good one.
No, what I was going to say, actually...
Jason, insert that at the end. Say,
no,
Lisa says Walk the Line is great. I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
I can't stand that movie.
Yeah, I know.
You know I can't stand that movie.
We
there
saw
are
that
so
the
many
theater.
Reasons.
Jason, put that in.
No, and this actually goes back to my contention that you do slices of life instead of the whole life.
But not Lust for Life, as we've established.
No, I'm going to go with, it's actually a tie between the Marie Antoinette that was made in 1938...
Uh-huh.
With Norma Shearer as Marie Antoinette.
Sure.
And then the Marie Antoinette that Sofia Coppola made in 2006.
Interesting!
And here is...
You're the person who likes that movie.
I do. Here is what... Because the most pointed criticism I would make about Sofia Coppola is she is somebody who's very much... She really doesn't trouble her beautiful head about, deeper meaning, deeper themes. She will never ever make a searing any movie that doubles as a searing indictment of inequality. She is somebody who grew up in luxury and has stayed in luxury, and now she's very interested in documenting the experience of living in luxury.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what makes her perfect for doing the Marie Antoinette she does, which takes your character from when she's a 14-year-old political pawn all the way through when she flees Versailles, and it begins the beginning of the end. And again, it's a very specific slice where it's a girl without much agency turning into a woman with some agency. And, you know, over the course of the film, Kirsten Dunst does a great job of portraying somebody who grows into, who basically grows into the life that she's been forced to live. Kirsten Dunst's performance is very, very good. It's very, very sharp. It's worth watching for that alone. And also, it's beautiful because Sofia Coppola does have an eye for luxury. She does have an eye for composition. And she is a... It's almost tactile the way that she lingers on things like excessively embroidered gowns and plates of macarons and the sheer unthinking, completely amoral animal pleasure that people take in nice things. So I found it compelling because it's a perfect marriage of director and material and subject. That said, it's a tie with 1938's Marie Antoinette, because that is the biopic where Norma Shearer plays it to the end of the execution. And bear in mind, this is 1938. She gives a performance that at the end is so raw and so nakedly human and so universal.
And not of 1938 at all.
No, it is timeless. Yeah. It is stunning. It is to watch an actress operating at her peak.
Who was Louis XVI in that?
I'm checking right
now.
I'm
going to, because I remember the guy who played...
Robert Morley.
Oh, right.
Breaks your heart with his dignity.
Yeah.
And the way that she finally settles into her marriage and then into her role as his queen and his partner and the love that they have for their children, it's a phenomenal movie. It's heartbreaking toward the end. And the reason it's a triumphal biopic is because it takes this person who is, you know, essentially an enormous historical figure with a great deal of ambiguity swirling around her in some aspects and a great deal of symbolism projected onto her, and it strips her down to this is the person who makes the humanity, you know, this is why she turns into something that's larger than she is. So that's the first one that comes to mind. Like I said, you know, like Tonight Later, but no, wait, it's this. But right.
No, those are as good a choice as any.
Yeah. And like I said, slices of life. I don't like it when you go beginning to end.
So our picks are Beyond the Sea with Kevin Spacey and oh man, we should do the video podcast just so I could see you flinch.
Yeah.
Everyone would just that involuntary shudder. No, don't see that one.
No, the only thing Walk the Line was good for was it made the movie Walk Hard that much funnier.
Yes. Yeah. Well, something had to.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's 50 minutes on Steve Jobs that we just did.
Yeah. So that was basically it.
So what's the other trailer we wanted to talk about?
Well, we want to talk about Spectre, which was the James Bond trailer.
Okay.
And bearing in mind, I say this, I'm coming to you because
I'm not a huge Bond fan.
I thought you're a bigger Bond fan than I am.
That's true. I've seen 3 more Bond movies than you probably have.
I think I've seen 2, and one of them was with you.
Yeah,
because I saw the one where
we saw Casino Royale,
where they whacked Daniel Craig in the Family Jewels. That was the one I remember seeing.
That's what sticks with you.
It does. How would it not?
Yeah,
because there was a movie I saw in the 1980s that involved like a snake and somebody getting things done with nails through parts.
Don't think we need to go on in this vein.
Really?
No.
We can do an entire podcast about it to middle.
Nope.
Okay. So as I was watching this movie where James Bond apparently has like a shopping list of people to kill and there's a shadowy organization.
This would be Spectre.
Yeah. And
we've moved on to Spectre for those of you keeping track of
that. And a bad guy where when we're watching the trailer, the bad guy comes on my lead.
He emerges in shadows for a moment because he kind of looks like Daniel Craig. So I thought, oh God, he's chasing himself.
He emerged from shadows and then you see the full face of the villain. And I leaned over towards Phil in the theater and I whispered, is that Rob Lowe in a really bad blonde wig?
Yeah, that's what you said.
No, and it's Christoph Waltz.
It's Christoph Waltz. So this Mr. Bond, I am the author of Arthur.
But he's like a dead ringer for that mate for the Rob Lowe in Drew Peterson.
Yeah.
Like, do you remember I made you watch that Rob Lowe as Drew Peterson made for TV?
Hey,
movie?
Now that we're on biopics.
That are terrible. But, so we watched that, and Rob Lowe's got on this patently terrible wig, and then we watched this Spectre thing, and I was flashing back. So the thing I wanted to ask you about was, I don't know if you were aware of this recently, somebody attached to the Bond films, and I don't remember who, said that the reason Idris Elba could never play James Bond is he is too, quote-unquote, street.
Yeah.
Well, and yet...
Well, that would be code, Lisa.
Is it just
me? That would be dog whistle traffic.
Yeah. Is it just me, or does Daniel Craig seem a little rough around the edges? He's not dapper.
No, he's...
Like Idris Elba, who is God's gift to all of us.
Yeah.
Ian seems like he would wear the heck out of a tux and be, like, completely smooth and charming.
Idris Elba would be a fine James Bond.
Yeah.
He would be a perfectly acceptable James Bond. He might even be a great James Bond. Keep in mind, I have no great...
Yeah.
Oh, it all went downhill when Sean Connery's...
Anyway, the problem with Spectre also is they have a logo that's similar to Hydra, so if you've been watching Marvel movies for the last however many years, at this point you're just kind of like, oh, Jesus, really James Bond is tying into the Marvel universe?
Also, the dude from The Hours is Q, I think. Or The Hour.
Ben Whishaw.
Yeah, on the BBC show.
Did I make you watch The Hollow Crown with me where he was Richard?
You wouldn't force me to watch Shakespeare. Like Shakespeare.
You do. You minored in Shakespeare.
But at the time, I was busy on some things and couldn't watch it. And then our TiVo got full and all those episodes got deleted. Yeah. So no, I did not see him in that.
Oh, he's very good.
I imagine he would be good at... As he was Richard II?
Yes.
That is the part he was born to play.
Yeah, he does do a great job at Snakey. Mm-hmm. Ben Whishaw is like a snake with really great hair.
When I lived in L.A., Kelsey Grammer played Richard II in a production. That was not good casting.
Again, if you could just see my face right now.
Yeah.
I'm just, no.
I have wasted time, and now time wastes me, Lilith.
He's Falstaffian.
Yeah.
No.
No, well, he was Richard II in this production.
No, he's not Richard II. Mm-mm, I refuse to believe it. So
I've also seen John Lovitz in a Chekhov play, so I have just run the gamut.
Sorry.
The Three Sisters, he was in that one.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And Nancy Travis was in that, too. It was
cherry trees, huh?
she was good.
Yeah, of course.
John Lovitz wasn't bad.
What is Nancy Travis up to these days?
I have no idea.
Maybe she's listening to this.
Maybe she is. Hey, I loved you in the 1991 production of The Cherry Tree in La Jolla, Nancy Travis.
You were great. Wow. And John Lovitz was in that one, too?
John Lovitz was in that one, too.
Wow.
You were okay, John.
Yeah.
You punched above your weight, and that's great.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the
Heart of the Sea.
It's called In the Heart of the Sea.
The Heart of the Sea.
So this is the trailer that showed immediately before The Martian.
We have had a request to do this.
And
I was maybe we'll do it. And then we saw the trailer.
And let me tell you, all of the air went out of the theater.
Yes.
The minute,
as if we were on Mars and our little hovel
been
breached.
Bear in mind, we live in the San Francisco Bay Area. So the minute you see a bunch of men heading out,
tell what the movie is about. It's about whalers.
Yes, it's about whalers who go out and the sperm and a quote unquote bull sperm whale actually breaks down their whaling boat and they're stranded at sea for months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
There is a shot in the trailer where you see just a pod of sperm whales. They're just swimming, and then you see like this horde of tiny whaling boats about to descend on them for the slaughter. And that was when the entire theater, as one, just did a horrified.
Yeah.
Like, there was literally no one in this theater that was at all excited about this movie.
You can't judge tones of movies from the trailer, but it's going to be a very difficult ask.
Let's put it this way. At the end of the trailer, at the very last scene, it fades and you see the credits. And I said very wildly, Team Whale. And someone behind me was like, yeah.
Well, yeah. The
like,
It is very difficult to do a movie where the sympathetic heroes of the movie, or the people you're supposed to at least identify with, are
murdering whales.
Are killing whales. It would be like doing, we're going to do 12 Years a Slave, but it's going to be from the point of view of the overseer.
Hard it is when these slaves keep running off.
What
and
a
now
hard life he had.
Yeah. No, and what didn't help is that day, Phil, I had watched the three-part British nature series called Ocean Giants, which is all about whales. And they basically raise things like, oh, whales live in very complicated and sophisticated social groups where, multiple generations at a time, and they tenderly care for their own young and others. And whales are capable of abstraction because they associate really sophisticated series of noises with each other. So that suggests that they have names and concepts that are actually, associated with specific whales. They transmit culture to each other. They transmit culture from pod to pod with different hunting techniques and different things. And they're probably as intelligent, if not more intelligent, than we are. We just haven't figured out a way to communicate with them. And so you've got all this swirling in your head with, oh my gosh, this planet's amazing, and bowhead whales live up to 200 years. And then I go see...
And then Thor comes along.
To kill a whale. Mm-hmm. And
to kill a whale. That was Harper Lee's third book.
Or Atticus
Finch. Where Atticus is just really racist and says...
And on top of this, decides to start killing whales.
He tasks me.
No, but...
Because it's Gregory Peck in both movies, you see.
Of course, that they dig up the corpse of Gregory Peck to go hang out and kill whales with Thor. Is that what's going to happen now? So, you know, we see this, and you're supposed to obviously, like, sympathize with these terrified people who are sliding down riggings and broken mizzen masts, and their little dinghies are getting upended by a whale who's understandably upset that these little hairless monkeys are slaughtering his wife and his children. And all I could think was, get them, whale.
Yeah, and apparently this is... I don't know if it's based on a true story.
It purports to be based
on the story that actually influenced the
about the sinking of the whale ship Essex in 1820.
That inspired Herman Melville to write Moby Dick.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there you go.
So, yeah, that was it. Basically, it was a cabin boy who, apparently a cabin boy passed on the experience, and then Melville takes it from there. And
yep.
Chris Hemsworth obviously does not play a cabin boy. He plays something impossibly handsome.
He plays a cabin man.
He plays something impossibly handsome because it's Chris Hemsworth. But again, I want to point out that you're asking people to root against a whale.
Yep.
It would be like making a movie about people who go into...
Unicorn killers!
No, I was about to say, it's about making a movie about people who go into bamboo forest to kill pandas.
Yeah. Panda had it coming.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's... Or... Just... I just keep thinking, all right, so historically speaking, maybe there's like a passage in the front where you see like a bunch of starving orphans and they're like, well, father, if it weren't for your whale oil, we'd all be dead of the croup. And then you're like, oh, here's the
snake. Whale blubber's the only thing keeping me alive this winter.
Exactly. Like, maybe there's that stake, but otherwise, and you're like, oh, he's just a family man and these are the times and we can't judge him by our 21st century mores. I'm pretty comfortable judging, actually.
Cut to James Madison in the White House. We should not have built an economy on whale things.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's...
I guess it would have been James Monroe.
Yeah.
By that time.
And also, and this is something that we talked about a little bit on the way home from The Martian when we weren't busy complaining about the disco, or rather when one of us wasn't busy complaining about the disco.
Yeah.
That
was awful of you to keep harping on that. The disco. And your hatred of it.
Mm-hmm. But there's that... movie that's coming out, The Finest Hours, I believe it is. Yes, The Finest Hours, which is when the Coast Guard goes to rescue a ship during a blizzard.
We've talked about this
one. And it's got Chris Pine. The thing is in both of those movies, like, after a while, it's just some really attractive actor getting buckets of water thrown on him.
Okay, since I've asked the biopic question, is there a good movie...
Made on the Sea?
Made on the Sea... I'm going to exclude submarine movies because there's no such thing as a bad submarine movie. Mm. Even that one where John Bon Jovi is in it.
Because he gets decapitated. That's what makes it great.
Yeah, he dies in the first reel.
That's
so.
The Oscar-winning U-571.
Oscar-winning U-571.
Yeah. Bon Jovi gets decapitated in the first reel is awesome.
So sub-movies are excluded since sub-movies are great.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, we'll take it for granted, Jaws.
Yeah.
Which we've talked about
before. No, Jaws is like the universe of infinite Phil Hartman.
But is there another movie where everyone goes to see and it's a fantastic movie?
I should point out that I really love A Perfect Storm.
Okay. That's fair. Why don't you marry it then? If it's so perfect.
I would. It's dreamy. It drowns things. I love it, and it might be one of the closest... It might be one of the movies that comes the closest to solving the problem of scale, because the thing that makes the ocean so awesome and so fearful is when you are standing on the beach looking out at that vast infinite stretch, you realize you literally have no idea where it ends. It's beyond your puny conception as a single person, right?
Yeah.
And the problem with trying to put the ocean on a screen is either, again, it turns into it's a giant soundstage and you're busy throwing buckets of water on an attractive person, or you're doing a lot of CGI with models and the eye is not fooled.
Right.
The Perfect Storm kind of very neatly bypasses this because they throw the buckets of water on attractive people in the dark. So the edges of the scope are kind of blurry, as it were, and you can kind of fill it in with your mind. And number two, the model is basically, look, here's a giant wave. Smash! And waves are cool. So so there's that. I can't think of too many other seafaring movies that I've seen, to be honest.
Okay. Some people like Master and Commander.
I've never seen it.
It's okay.
I've only seen like bits and pieces here and there. Also, also Master and Commander honestly sounds like...
Not a good name for a movie.
No, because it sounds like it should be about two dudes who are like topless and wearing fireman pants and in the back section of a video store.
I was going to say a 1930s comedy team, the comedy stylings of Master and Commander.
No, I went
But
to
you went in a different direction.
Same-sex adult entertainment is where I went.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Master.
So, Master, I understand that we got a baseball team here. That's right, Commander. They sure got some funny names.
I'm your Master and your Commander. Yeah. Yes, sir.
So that one's okay. I was gonna say... Well,
Little Mermaid, maybe.
Sure.
Because animation gets around all of the limitations of the
scope. I have not seen this movie. I understand All Is Lost is gets to capturing the vastness and of the sea and how it will crush us all.
The problem is it has Robert Redford in it.
Yes, but he dies, so...
Okay, you...
Spoiler!
You may have persuaded me.
Spoiler alert, yeah, everyone who...
You may have persuaded
didn't
me.
Didn't know the outcome of that movie. And... The sea battle scene in Ben-Hur is quite compelling.
Oh, there's a shark movie called The Deep Blue Sea with Saffron Burroughs and Samuel Jackson in it that I quite like because it takes place in an underwater research station where inexplicably they've decided it's a good idea to give aggressive sharks genius IQs.
Oh, yeah. I've got one.
Huh.
This is actually a legit, not a great movie, but a good movie. Uh-huh. Nicole Kidman and Sam Neill.
Oh, they're on this boat.
They're on the boat.
Dead Calm.
Dead Calm.
Dead Cam. As
Dead Cam. Because
it
it's all, yeah. Uh-huh. All Australians.
Oh, yes, that was a great movie.
That's a good watch.
Yeah. Anyway, long story short, though, in the heart of the sea, it looks like it's going to be a bunch of hunky men starving in a sailboat.
Yep.
And
rowboat.
And let us remind you that, once again, they put themselves in that situation by choosing to senselessly slaughter dozens of some of the most intelligent creatures on Earth without any regard for them whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So, not really having a lot of sympathy here for them.
Yeah. Ron Howard, for me as a director, is a pretty mixed bag.
Yeah. Well, he also did Austrians Melt in the Car.
We've talked about this before. Rush.
Oh, okay.
Rush.
Invisible.
Yes. Boy, if
I assure Niki Lauda has not.
Niki Lauda has recovered from the first slight in a previous episode. Well, maybe I'll give them another listen. They're not going to talk about me again in a disrespectful way. Oh, what the hell?
Well, did he or did he not melt in a car?
He didn't melt in a car. He was burnt severely in a car.
You
make
melted.
Him sound like a wicked witch and that he's driving. I'm driving now. I'm going to win the Formula One title. And like a Kansas schoolgirl comes with a bucket and, oh no! My van weakness!
You know, I'm not the one giving you the terrible accent.
That is a very fine accent.
I really hope we do have Austrian listeners who are going to write it and let us know how the accent goes.
Mm-hmm.
So should it be Austrian drivers are flammable? And would you prefer if I started referring to them that way?
I think pretty much all drivers are flammable, regardless of nationality, if they are involved in a wreck.
Also true. Then again, the friend Andy, to whom I was talking yesterday about The Martian, asked me, he's like, well, what is that movie where Matt Damon, he said, there's that other space movie Matt Damon made. I said, oh, Matt Damon staples on armor and does a class war. And he's like, oh, Elysium, you mean? So clearly, I can't remember movie titles.
No.
It doesn't work. Matt Damon staples on some armor and does a class war.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Elysium.
Yeah.
Which I, Elysium.
No, I don't know how much we got into Ron Howard's oeuvre
before. We did.
Yeah.
We did get into
Mixed bag for me.
Yeah.
Especially his latter stuff.
You know, I can see where, as a director, it's an interesting challenge to say, okay, this is a way of life that's completely extinct and now considered morally important in most of the country, most countries in the world. But these were human beings. There is some sort of universality of the human condition here. My challenge is to bring that to life.
Yep.
But again, want to remind you, you're killing whales. You're killing intelligent creatures. Mm-hmm. Creatures that are capable of extremely complex levels of communication here. Creatures that have active and rich emotional lives and social bonds that are equivalent to anything people have. And you're murdering them because you want to light them on fire in a lamp. So, you know, you're already starting off with a handicap here.
Don't forget the perfume.
Oh, the ambergris, yes. Yeah. And the whale, and the corsets.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whalebone corsets.
We're killing whales for misogyny is what we're doing.
I can't think of a better reason.
God.
Two wrongs make a right.
Okay. kind of math is that?
I don't know.
Is that Common Core? Is that how that works now?
Well, I guess I won't last long on Mars then.
No, you won't be able to science out of it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we are, I would not even say neutral on the heart of the sea. It's just a giant eye roll unless the reviews convince us otherwise. Mm-hmm. Because again, they're killing whales. That's a really big obstacle to get over.
Yep.
And like Phil kept saying on the way home, because we walked home after seeing The Martian, and Phil just kept saying, it's like if you made 12 years a slave from the perspective of overseers who were like all worked up about how hard it was to keep slaves around.
So and yeah, not a terrible. Not interested in it.
No, not at all.
Not going to see it.
Not really interested in Spectre.
I am, but okay. I've enjoyed the recent Bond movies.
Yes, even though he is, not Idris Elba.
No, well, few of us are in life.
That's what.
If you don't see movies that, if you only go to see movies that Idris Elba is in, you will limit yourself, and you will see lots of Thor.
There is actually one that's coming out now called Beasts of No Nation, where he plays a military commander in an unnamed African country, where his group basically goes through, terrorizes villages, and recruits child soldiers. Mm. And it is the kind of movie that sounds vital and necessary and important, and that I will absolutely not watch, because now that I have a kid, I am way too soft and sensitive to watching children get traumatized on film. Mm. Can't do it for entertainment anymore.
Yeah.
So, anyway. So that's it. This is, pretty much just me overall the previews we saw. Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything fun we want to see. There's a Pixar movie about dinosaurs coming up, but I haven't seen any previews for it yet.
No.
Although it's Pixar, so, and it's one of the rare non-sequel movies they're putting out.
Yeah.
So, there's that. Anyway, if we see more previews, we will certainly not hesitate to talk about them. If you have any suggestions for us, we would love to hear them.
Tweet at us.
Yeah, we do. And
Facebook at us.
And whoever suggested that we take a look at Chris Hemsworth Wants to Kill Some Whales.
You win.
Yes.
We took a look at it.
Yes.
And you're a winner.
We're very sad now. We hope you're happy.
Yeah.
All right. And on that note, I'm ending Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies. I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
I am your host, Philip Michaels. Snuck it in there at the end.
I let you.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Good night.